Next up, we're going to talk about emotion. Michael Jauer with us. His latest book is called Sensitive Soul, and we'll take calls with him next hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you a little bit about Michael Jauer, a Washington, D.C.-based writer, speaker, researcher. His expertise is the personality development area, body, mind, emotion, spirituality. He's the author with Mark Micozzi, MD, PhD, of a couple books, The Spiritual Anatomy of Emotion and Your Emotional Type. The latest book by Mr. Michael Jauer is Sensitive Soul, The Unseen Role of Emotion in Extraordinary States. And Michael, we have all gone through some emotional states over the past year, haven't we?
Oh my gosh. Jeez. We may just be getting started. I'm not sure.
I think so. Well, welcome to the program, and thanks for staying up so late for us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, George.
How did you get involved in this area?
Well, in a completely unlikely way, looking back about 25 years, I would have never guessed that I've gotten into researching and writing about the subjects I have. It really got started when I was in the mid-1990s working in the commercial real estate industry and researching something called sick building syndrome, which is primarily office buildings, sometimes residential buildings, where people are in the buildings, they don't feel well, they get kind of cold and flu type symptoms.
Okay.
And when they're outside of the buildings, they feel much better. So the buildings seem to be the culprit. The question is why? And working with an association of building owners and managers, I was tasked with working with folks with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to develop guidance to prevent sick buildings and keep people well, and then sort of develop protocols for what you do if, you know, if you're a building manager, engineer, and there is something like this, a situation like this. And I started speaking with a variety of people, obviously the building managers and engineers to begin with, but ultimately the building occupants and folks who were sidelined because of these symptoms. And they told me that in many cases they had been sensitive to various things in their environment years before, which raised the question just what might be going on here. Is the building ultimately the problem, or could it be an interaction between the building and the person? And I became aware, as people started to confide in me, in a couple of more esoteric conditions. One is called multiple chemical sensitivity, where people are highly reactive to things like perfumes and colognes and paints and pesticides.
Right.
So that's, you know, that was kind of interesting. And then some people told me about their electrical sensitivity, feeling like they were influenced by and influenced electrical appliances, lights and computers especially. And then the kicker was that some of these folks, as I had sort of more ongoing conversations and more ultimately confidential, the individuals anyway, was the fact that they had experienced things like apparitions and could see energies around people, and that they felt this was a pronounced form of sensitivity, emotional, primarily, that they'd had for many years. So that sort of piqued a lot of questions, and the study and writing I've done ever since really sprang from that.
These buildings that help create the sick building syndrome, were like asbestos and chemicals in the building, things like that?
Yeah, asbestos, not so much. It's really sort of mold in buildings is a big trigger, is a big factor. You know, people have mold in their homes as well. It's sort of endemic, or can be. And one thing, George, that sort of tipped me off that this is a sort of interesting path to research is that at that same time, my wife and I had moved into a new house, which is where I'm speaking to you from, and we were working, we had a sort of shared office, and it turned out there was mold in that room. Now, my wife has been asthmatic since she was born, unfortunately, and she would react immediately to this.
Right, right.
I could be in that room simultaneously and just sort of be aware that there's kind of a musty odor, not be really put off by it. And so I had a very clear example of different people reacting differently in a room that could be considered sick, and we obviously had that remedied very quickly. But this was happening all at the same time, so it sort of gelled.
And then you somehow got into the emotional end of all this, too, which is amazing.
Yeah, I became convinced, and am convinced, and have written about this extensively, that sensitivity, when you consider that term, there's a physical side to it where people are, you know, allergic in many cases. I think migraine is a good example of physical sensitivities, but simultaneously emotional sensitivities, and allergy and migraine are probably good examples of that. When people are riled up, when they are stressed, they're certainly more likely to get colds or infections. Their allergies kick in. My wife's asthma can be worsened by emotional stress. And migraine is set off by all kinds of things. Most people think of it, you know, in terms of smells and glare and noise and things like that, which is certainly true. But the primary trigger for most people is emotion. So it's very difficult to separate out emotion from you know, physical prompts. They sort of are all wrapped up in one, and that's, again, what I've tried to explore quite a bit.
How did you get to know the poltergeist investigator, William Rohl? How did that happen?
That also sprang, interestingly enough, from my work on indoor air quality. I was, again, this is back in the probably mid to late 1990s, getting interested in these subjects. And I've always had an interest in parapsychology as well. There are some experiences I've had in my family or my family has had, and I think some of this may actually be genetic as well. Anyway, that was kind of in the back of my mind, especially when I was talking to people who'd been affected by so-called sick buildings or sick building syndrome, and they told me they had these sort of pre-existing sensitivities and particular proclivities towards paranormal perception. And I was speaking at a small conference on indoor air quality in the Atlanta area, and I remembered that Bill Rohl, who was a renowned and still, you know, very noteworthy poltergeist investigator, was in the Atlanta region. So I sent him a letter, called him up, and he very graciously agreed to meet with me. And so we were kicking these things around, and one thing that struck me, George, at the time was that Bill Rohl's assistant had all the cluster of symptoms and complaints that I had been talking with these folks in the sick building context about, the very same one.
Jeez.
Migraine, she was allergic, she saw apparitions, she felt vibrations in rooms and so forth. And Bill told me something that I've never forgotten. He said, if you go back to the 19th century, in the turn of the 20th century, when parapsychology was in vogue and mediums were all the rage, he said they weren't really called mediums, they were called sensitives, and they were known as sensitives. And so that really put me 100% on sort of this concept of sensitivity, and Bill subsequently suggested, why don't you do a survey to try to systematize the data that you're getting, the stories that you're getting from people, change them from anecdotes into actual data, ask particular questions, and see what you come up with. And so that led to the publication of a survey in the Journal for the Society of Psychical Research, the group out of the UK that has a very illustrious pedigree going back to the late 1800s, William James, and I think the Arthur Conan Doyle was
right.
Sherlock Holmes was a member, and so forth. So I was thrilled to get published by them. That was my first paper, and went through that whole process. And I believe the findings stand up to this day, and that's a lot of what I've written about.
When you wrote the book Sensitive Soul, the new book that's just come out, tell me about the title. That's I find it to be very clever, but tell me its meaning.
Right. So sensitive refers to the fact that each of us is a sensate being. You know, we have to be sensitive to make sense out of our environment.
Mm-hmm.
So our senses and emotions provide a key to that. Emotions tell us how we're feeling, you know, how we are in any given environment. Is this relationship right or wrong for me? So sensitivity is, again, both physical and emotional, and kind of orients us as individuals. Soul refers to our spiritual capacity, which I also argue is very much tied to emotion, to feeling. The feelings we have for one another, for our pets, for nature, you know, for things that are going on in the world. You mentioned, you know, recent events. Everybody gets riled up over those. You know, all of this underlies, in my opinion, our spirituality, fellow feeling, the feeling that we have for other people in this life. And I think the deeper our feeling, the deeper our spirituality. So you put those two together, and that's my concept of sensitive soul.
I'm fascinated by the concept of deja vu, that feeling that you know something's going to happen or you've been there before. How does that equate into sensitive soul?
Ooh, I have the glimmer of a feeling that you've asked me this question before. Just kidding. Just kidding.
And you've been on before. No, your first time.
Hasn't happened, but deja vu is remarkable because so many of us have, you know, experienced deja vu, and it's quite striking.
It's a weird feeling. It's a very weird sensation.
It's like you're between this and that, and it's this faint, you know, sense that I've been here before, this has happened before, doing some sort of time travel, and there are all kinds of proposed explanations for it. Interestingly enough, there is no single accepted, you know, sort of mainstream explanation of deja vu. But there's an explanation that I particularly have been drawn to, and that I write about in the new book, and that is that it very well may relate to being in a situation where you're reminded of something that did happen before in your life, and there's some cue in the environment that tips you off to that. And so you start to remember, and it's sort of unconscious. And at the same time, there was something in that memory that's unpleasant or that your unconscious doesn't want to fully realize and bring into the present. And so it shuts it off. And I've experienced this myself in one situation where, you know, reflecting on it, I thought, oh, that's probably what was going on. And I think that at least it was a satisfying explanation for me.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it could explain many other, maybe not all, instances of deja vu, but I think that the subconscious is at work, and the subconscious typically is responsible for a lot more of our experience and our perception than we give it credit for.
And the experience, you can feel it coming on, can't you?
Yes, it's eerie in that way. It absolutely is. It sort of dawns on you, the impression dawns on you, and then you don't quite have the full appreciation for it. You're not really sure what you're on the cusp of, and then it goes away.
Is there anything supernatural to it? I've got a friend who's a doctor, and he thinks it's like some kind of frontal lobe epilepsy. So he goes the medical way. I'd rather go the more supernatural way.
Well, like I say, there are a lot of explanations for it. If folks go on to go online, there are, and YouTube, for example, there are many very, very well presented explanations. And neurologically, there's a lot going on. There's a lot to unpack. I happen to like this particular explanation because it seemed to explain a very striking instance of deja vu that I had. And again, I'm sort of predisposed to look into the unconscious. And when you talk about the supernatural, I think the unconscious has a lot to do with what we talk about as supernatural. And a lot of it is out of our awareness, which is why it seems so eerie.
You talk about PTSD, and you say there are a couple types of PTSD. Explain that.
Yes, this is one of the more surprising, perhaps, outcomes of my research. I just thought there's one kind of PTSD, which is the typical, when people think of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, they think of sort of the flashbulb memory. You know, there's a veteran of Vietnam or Iraq and
right, Afghanistan, all that.
Afghanistan, yeah. And of course, people that have gone through a natural disaster or some sort of trauma where someone has threatened them, it's a life-threatening emergency. And again, something in the environment, almost like deja vu, there's something in the environment that triggers this recollection. And, you know, it could be a car backfiring and the person feels like they're back on the battlefield.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, all of the smells, all the sights, all the sound, all the fears come rushing back and they're overwhelmed and they can't tell left from right. And that's the flashbulb form of PTSD. What I discovered is that in the last 5 to 7 years, there's been research into what's called a dissociative form of PTSD, which affects between, I think the numbers are 15% to 30% of people that have it. And dissociation is the term for when you are sort of at a distance from your feelings, and it's sort of automatic and it kicks in. It's what I think is happening in deja vu. What happens for this percentage of people with PTSD is, again, there's something that prompts the recollection, but this mechanism kicks in, dissociation, and they can't really grasp it. They just feel like something is amiss, and sort of the opposite of the flashbulb type of PTSD, they can't really visualize or crystallize what it is that's bothering them, and it sort of feels like a funk or walking through, you know, fog, and it goes on, and they can't really get out of it, and this is the dissociative form of PTSD, and it relates, in my estimation, I think there's good evidence for this, it relates to two personality types, George, or at least two ends of a personality spectrum, and two very pronounced and very different reactions to a situation. What they had in mm-hmm. common was, you know, something that provoked great fear and anxiety once upon a time, but two very different reactions and two different forms of PTSD.
You know, and different people, as you say, react to it in different ways. But some people who have been on the battlefield never get PTSD.
No, that's right, and most people do not, in natural disasters as well, but there are a heck of a lot of people that do, and that raises the larger question. You're very shrewd to point this out, is that most people don't, and so that's the initial question. Why do some people get PTSD and others not? And then, of course, why do some people suffer from this sort of variation of it? And it relates, I think, to a broad spectrum of personality and, in some sense, how people are wired, especially emotionally, what registers with them. And I come back to the term sensitivity. I think some people are prone or primed, in effect, to be traumatized, and they may not know it, but it's just kind of how they are. And other people they're much more resilient, and they can walk away from something that would affect somebody else quite severely.
One of our favorite guests, Dean Radin, wrote a nice little snippet for you about your book on the back cover. He says, a fascinating tour, the hidden influences that make us who we are and that hold the clues to some truly extraordinary abilities. And he knows what he's talking about, Michael.
He does. Dean is a great guy, and he's been studying far more than I have over a longer period of time. And Dean's one of the people that I've leaned on. I've been very fortunate in writing these books to work with some terrific people. The co-author of my first two books, Mark McCosey, knows a heck of a lot about integrative healthcare and really the way we can consider people holistically, and that outlook has really helped me to sort of come along and put the pieces together.
It's an amazing work. We're going to talk more about your work. You even get into animals, don't you?
Quite a bit, much more, again, than I ever thought I would. They're all around us, and they're mammals like we are, so there's a lot that we can observe about our own functioning in our pets and our animal friends.
When we take calls next hour with folks, if anybody has had some emotional episodes, how do you feel comfortable with them sharing that with you?
Yes, absolutely. Nothing should be out of bounds, absolutely, positively.
And since you started putting this together, what have you concluded about people that in terms of how their emotions differ from different people, how people react to stress, how people don't? Is there a common barometer here or denominator?
Yeah, this is going to sound odd, but our commonality is our diversity. We are all human beings, but there are no two people who truly see the world and experience the world identically. Maybe if they're identical twins, maybe. I'm not even so sure on that.
That's true.
But, yeah, everybody's different. We see this in our political environment in the last many months and weeks. People get affected by different things and experience things very differently. But to me, emotion is the bottom line. Emotion is what drives us. It's the source of our strength in the world, our animation, our energy to get up and do things. It's what we, you know, feel moved about. That's emotion.
All right, we'll get into more of this, your work, Sensitive Soul, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Michael Jauer with us. Michael, in Sensitive Soul, you devote a couple chapters to our little furry friends. Tell me about that.
So, like I said, animals are all around us. They are mammals. I'm convinced, I use this phrase a lot, that they live life closer to the bone. They don't have the sort of fully fledged capacities that we do mentally, they're able to think clearly and react to their environment and make decisions. But the sort of rumination that human beings are prone to, our form of language, the way we collect and store information, process information, there's a lot that's unique to us. But underneath all that is the animal functioning. People are animals too. I mean, we are animals just as much as anybody. We sometimes forget that. And because of that, I look to animals to learn some lessons about human beings. And in particular, what strikes me is that animals very often are connected with paranormal or anomalous goings-on. I mean, we have many examples you read from time to time about a dog sort of wandering away from a family somewhere, let's say it's in Kansas, and the family is actually located in Rhode Island, and mm-hmm. They can't find the dog, and you know, 6 months or a year later, the dog's all bedraggled and manages to find its way back to Rhode Island.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Yeah.
So there's something going on there, and there are many examples. I've lived a couple in my own family of pets, and there are many examples of this in different accounts all over the place throughout history, that animals seem to be connected in many ways with loss of life, and animals reacting strangely or seemingly at the same time as somebody passes from this life. So there's a lot to be learned, and that's why I devote chapters to animals.
You use a phrase called mirror senses. What does that mean?
Mirror sensing is, again, something that I had no inkling about before I delved into this research, and I started studying something called synesthesia, which is overlapping senses, like feeling a color or tasting a shape or smelling a sound. I had done a survey. I think I mentioned about the survey that Bill Roll, the poltergeist mm-hmm. Expert, had suggested, and he actually helped me to frame that survey. And as people responded to the survey, and ultimately we had about 200 people, both sensitive people that said, I'm responding because I'm highly sensitive, and there was another control group that said, I'm not particularly sensitive. And so we had answers to be able to compare and contrast. But people wrote back to me and said, I have something called synesthesia. Now, I was asking about allergies and migraine and chronic fatigue and things like that, and I didn't know what synesthesia was. It's these overlapping senses, and people seem to come into the world wired this way, and they're surprised as heck when they find out around, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 years of age, that not everybody perceives the world as they do. They think right. That everybody has conjoined senses. So mirror senses is an outgrowth of that. Mirror sensing is basically taking the perspective and feeling the perspective of someone that you see. And it's linked with synesthesia. It may or may not be a form of synesthesia, but especially pain is pronounced, George, and people that have mirror senses feel pain very keenly when they see somebody grimace, or when somebody, you know, drops something on their foot, or they're watching, you know, the Rocky movie or something, Rocky 8, and, you know, he gets hit in the face, that they react to that. So it doesn't actually have to be real violence. It can be something that's simulated on the screen, and people react the same way.
Why do some people
extreme empathy?
Why do some people laugh when something tragic happens? Somebody trips over a curb, and you hear people laugh, or somebody smashes into a glass window door, thinking that it's open or something, and people, not everybody, but people tend to laugh.
Yeah, I think part of it is the surprise. We sometimes laugh at something that just takes us by surprise, you know, the punchline of a joke. But there's also, even with the word punchline, and you know, comedians say, I killed tonight, or I died, I didn't go over well, I died. There's a real physicality to humor and a real emotional wallop to it, and I think that's people do react to things that have an emotional wallop with sometimes inappropriate reactions.
And with what's been going on with COVID-19, anxiety levels are high, divorce rates are high, suicide rates are high. What's causing this? I mean, a couple people have jumped off buildings, very wealthy people. They just took a dive. What's causing this?
Well, there's widespread stress in our society. A part of it has to do, I believe, with the physical distancing. I mean, again, we are mammals, and
we need people.
You need to be close to people. People are feeling isolated, and that's just not natural. One silver lining, if there is any, from this pandemic is, you may know that there aren't many dogs to be adopted anymore, because people really have desired to have that physical closeness.
They need that. That's
some
true.
Some creature.
Good
and
point.
Animals, you know, give and receive a lot of love. So that's to the good. It's one of the nice things that's come out of this.
Well, I got to tell you a couple things during this episode that has affected me. One, this radio show has kept my sanity because I'm dealing with people every night, phone calls and stuff. So you have that connection. The second thing I did, Michael, was I got to tell you, it has become fun to go to grocery stores because you see people there. It's crazy.
Yeah, things that we just took for granted really stand out now. I'll just mention something that's interesting. If you turn the clock back about 6 or 8 months, there was an article in the New York Times, of all places, about how people were reporting more ghosts in their residences, seemingly because of coronavirus and the reasons they interviewed people as to why that might be. I thought that was very interesting. It may be we're sort of turned back on ourselves in places that it may lead to imagination on the one hand. On the other hand, perhaps a more sort of more acuity in picking up what's happening in the environment that we overlook when we're not there all the time and sort of just by ourselves. There's a lot more we might pick up.
You seem to touch on in the book Sensitive Soul Reincarnation, especially with children. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I'm hesitant to use the word reincarnation because I don't know that that's what it is, but there are very, very well-documented cases of children up to about the age of 6 who have very vivid memories of someone else's life and in many cases someone else's death. And here again, I've drawn on some great research done by some terrific people. You mentioned Dean Radin, I mentioned Bill Roll. There's a guy named Jim Tucker at the University of Virginia, who's written books about this, and I imagine he's been on your program. Jim has documented very painstakingly, and he follows in the footsteps of a guy named Ian Stevenson, who got this going.
One of the best.
Yes, just hundreds, if not thousands, of cases from all around the world, including here in the United States, striking cases of kids who effectively have PTSD. And it raises the question, because they have these traumatic memories of something that happened to someone, and they can be very detailed about it. And the thing that Stevenson and Jim Tucker have done is, in many cases, put two and two together and identified the particular people that died, had these lives, and there's a lot of evidence connecting them with these particular kids. But why? It raises so many questions, and I think is all about emotion. The number that jumped out at me in talking with Jim Tucker and reading his work is that their combined database, the Stevenson-Tucker database, has, 70% of all of their cases involve the recollection of a violent demise. And that, to me, is the tip-off when it comes to PTSD and these kids having these very vibrant, intensive memories. There's a lot of emotion at work, and I tend to think that when people are in a life-or-death situation, or what they perceive as life-or-death, all of their bodily systems and mental functioning, and certainly emotion, is at red alert, and it's life-or-death. And if you've got no place to go, if you're stuck, if you have to be resigned to your fate in that situation, what happens to all that energy? I think of emotion as emotion, as sort of the feeling, feelings as what animates you, and the energy behind that. We feel it every day. If we're up, if we're down, if we're happy, if we're sad, every shade in between. Emotions are in our bodies, and there's a real energy and impetus to it. And if that's stuck, if it can't be expressed, And generally, to express emotion is healthy. If those feelings can't be expressed and you're in a traumatic situation, could there be reverberations? And I suggest in Sensitive Soul that this is what happens. And I look at some of these cases, and somehow the recollection of this person's life and this person's death is somehow transmitted to somebody else, another corner of the world 50 years later. How that happens, I have no idea. But it does suggest that emotion, strong emotion, transcends space and time. I don't know that it's reincarnation, however.
Did you ever come across the story of James Leininger, who was a little six-year-old who his parents believed was a World War II pilot in another life?
Absolutely. That's one of the cases that I look at in Sensitive Soul and lean very heavily on Jim Tucker's work. And that's a remarkable case.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
It had to do with an aircraft carrier in service in World War II. I think the Battle of Iwo Jima, the USS Natoma Bay. And what the little boy, James Leininger, would yell as he was slamming these toy planes into his parents' living room table and waking up with nightmares at night, he would yell, "Little man on fire, can't get out."
Can't get out, that's right.
And little man was the airman, and I identified who he was, that was trapped in this plane that was crashed and burned in the ocean. And there are so many details that this little boy would have had no way of knowing, and certainly no motivation to try and find out. So there are many cases like that that raise so many tantalizing questions.
He told his father they used to fly a Corsair and that the tires would go flat all the time. That was not very public. And the fact that the little kid knew that was astounding.
Yeah, it just knocks you for a loop when you read about this. And the other thing is, as you know, with that family, is their very conventional Christian family.
Oh yeah, very straight.
The idea of reincarnation or of past lives never would have occurred to them, and they had to puzzle it out. And it really drove their parents, the dad in particular, to try and identify what was going on. There's another case you may have read about a movie actor and I think agent named Marty Martin. And there was another boy whose name escapes me at the moment, who was obsessed with motion pictures in the 1930s and 40s, and would say that he belonged back in that time. And his mother sort of indulged this and was as puzzled as anybody, and got him photos, books of memorabilia from that era. And at one point, he was looking through one of these books with his mom, and he said, "Hey, Mom, that's me. That's me." And he pointed to a guy in a photograph who was, I think, with the actor George Raft, but they didn't know who George Raft was, and they didn't know anybody else in the photograph. And it turns out that all of the information that he volunteered led them to this guy named Marty Martin, and there were many details, again, that the boy volunteered that he would had no way of knowing, unless this was some extreme hoax cooked up by the family, but it seems very, very unlikely. There are many cases like this, and from all around the world. So I think that it has a lot to do with our emotional makeup and sort of the emotional current of our lives. And I believe that emotion can spill out into the environment and transcend time and space, which makes it so intriguing to me.
That little boy agent, his name was Ryan. I don't think they ever publicized his last name.
That's right, Ryan. Thank you.
But what a great story that was. And there are hundreds of stories like that, Michael. Hundreds!
Yeah. If somebody's trying to keep a secret in the universe, it's getting out. it's on us to try and figure out what this means.
What are your thoughts about...
I should say, not to ignore these stories. A lot of people are very resolute in saying, well, this can't happen, so it doesn't. But that doesn't really allow for the fact that it does.
What are your thoughts on autism? Because you believe there's something there, too.
Yes. As I studied autism, there's an approach to it or a theory that seems to be gaining currency. In fact, if you look at the autism literature and the websites, there's a lot written about sensitivity and how particularly sensitive and extra sensitive kids are with autism. And the phrase that has been used, at least by some researchers, is intense world syndrome. And the theory of the intense world is that people that are autistic or somewhere on the spectrum basically come into this world with excess neural connections, that they're hyper-connected, their brains, and so they're literally sensitive to so much more in the environment, and they're overloaded with sensation, and what they see, what they hear, what they smell, what they taste, what they touch, and especially what they feel. And a lot of parents of autistic kids have pointed out that their kids, and they tend to be boys, feel immensely about the world. But to cope with all of that sensation, that sort of tidal wave of sensation, the theory is that the kids retreat. They construct defenses, and they cut themselves off from this torrent of sensation, and it actually then goes the opposite direction, and especially at the age this happens, they need to be reaching out and developing relationships, but they retreat from social life, and so they end up being sort of withdrawn and seemingly sort of out of the usual flow of commerce in the world. But that may well be in reaction to an initial overstimulation, and it just raises big questions about how we all come into the world, and the other extraordinary conditions that I talk about in the book. I mentioned synesthesia, savantism, child prodigies.
Let's tell folks where they can get the book, Michael, when we come back. And your website, we've got linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, the final hour with Michael Jauer and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.